Welcome to the Six Figure Developer Podcast, the podcast where we talk about new and exciting technologies, professional development, clean code, career advancement, and more. I'm John Calloway.
I'm Clayton Hunt.
And I'm John Ash.
With us today is Joey Schluchter. Joey is a cloud-native technical specialist for Microsoft and a member of the global Black Belt Azure team. Welcome, Joey.
Hey, guys. How's everybody doing?
Doing pretty well. So just to get started, would you tell us a little bit about yourself, maybe how you got started in the industry?
Yeah, so started off, I was an Oracle DBA at a startup in Tampa, Revenue Management Solutions. This was 2000-ish, mm-hmm. Which was, we did site selection and pricing strategy for all sorts of companies. And then that morphed into creating, you know, being, I'd always played with development even as a child, but that morphed into creating, you know, dashboards for these customers. And then, you know, got a development job somewhere else at a startup, then another startup. Who is now he's a program manager on the Azure Red Hat OpenShift team, Jim Zimmerman, and it was for Thuzi in Tampa. That was my first really huge startup. Well, half of our team there wound up working for Microsoft, and so it was a natural progression. Now it's like 8 or 9 years later that I joined Microsoft, and but mostly development, and now that's morphed into containers, microservices. All the new hot open source stuff that Azure and the cloud has to offer. So,
okay. So you're now a cloud native technical specialist. So would you kind of give us a little bit about what a little bit more about what that really entails?
Okay. So the big move right now for customers is I want to densify my workloads. I want to, I've done this shadow IT thing where I've got all these, workloads out there, but I want to slim everything down. I want to actually get the most out of the compute I've got, or in some cases in machine learning, I want to leverage the power of Kubernetes and just have it kind of burst out and, run and train my models that I've got. So a majority of the customers that I deal with are in that space where they're taking, either older legacy applications or either completely cloud native new greenfield applications and moving them to a containerized workload. All right. And we have many options on Azure, but my specialty is specifically our Kubernetes service, or, if you want to roll your own, it's called AKS Engine, where you're just managing it yourself. But the big push is manage Kubernetes. And so with those customers, I help them, any blockers that they have, IP, networking issues, storage issues. So what will happen is I will, it normally revolves around having a few calls with them, talking about their issues. And then it could lead either, hopefully I can resolve it on the call. That would be great. But a lot of times it's deeper than that. And maybe they need some architectural guidance around, how they've structured their app or maybe how they've architected their hybrid connections. So we'll go on site. I'm one of now 12 cloud native technical specialists on the Black Belt team. We'll engage with these customers. We'll go on site. We'll either do a workshop or a code with type scenario where we'll help them resolve those issues and deploy to Azure along those lines. Huh. So it's deeply customer engaged. Let's put it that way.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
So to kind of roll back a little bit, could we talk maybe what a container is and talk about, so when, if we're talking about containerizing legacy applications, I'm sure maybe a lot of people probably know what that is, but could we talk about just what does that mean? And what is a container and why is it sort of special?
In its simplest form, a container is a unit of deployment, if you want to think about it like that. We all say microservices and, you know, all these nice buzzwords and everything like that. But in essence, it's a unit of deployment. There's been other... Java had a sandbox VM, and Microsoft had some different variants of that type of scenario where there was just a unit of deployment that you could have. But a container abstracts the OS away from you, you know, and it abstracts the secrets and, you know, connection strings away from you, where you're just passing them in, and you're able to deploy that unit of deployment, in this case a container, anywhere, and it should run the same. Okay. So in legacy workloads, there's a little bit of work for it, but the concept still rings true along all those things. You're taking a specific workload or a small piece of that workload and turning it into a unit of deployment, whatever that may be. It could be an email service. It could be, you know, just a RESTful API endpoint or many RESTful API endpoints, or, you know, it could be a data layer that's connecting out somewhere else.
Recently gave a talk at the at one of the local groups in the Tampa Microsoft office where you were talking about containerizing legacy applications. And you had a lot of insight, a lot of pointers, tips and tricks, a lot of things to avoid what would be a good application to containerize and what makes an application eligible to be containerized. You know, if we've got a lot of WinForms applications, can we just move everything to the cloud, or what does that entail?
So in WinForms or anything GUI-based, it's going to be extremely difficult. That's almost something that anything GUI-based, it's almost impossible. There are exceptions. I know people that run Chrome in containers and a little bit of... some browser, Mozilla, and there's a couple other ones that they can use just to have privacy or something like that. But anything else, it becomes very hard because of COM, MFC, the Windows container isn't as robust as Linux containers right now. It doesn't allow for, you know, some of the neat features. And it, basically, the concept of a container is not to have the... It's more of a service, you know, kind of deployment, and not a UI, you know, besides a website per se. It's more of a service deployment. And so a lot of the caveats that you run into or issues that you run into are COM, MFC, older DLLs, architecture issues. I've run into a few with the Pi that have done that, where you've got some, you know, you've got an ARM architecture over here and everything else is x86 or, you know, AMD type scenarios. And so you've built it over here on your Mac or your PC and, hey, it runs great, but then you take it over to the Pi and it breaks because of the ARM architecture. And that's, I'm using that as an edge case, but with Windows and some of those GUI, you know, kind of WinForms, issues or WPF type stuff, you run into that more and more often, where there's just some DLL issue or, you know, third party type stuff, and it just doesn't lend itself well to containerization. That's more of a, hey, let's deploy that either like a remote app or a Citrix type scenario where you're just porting that to the cloud. Now the underlying services that support it, hey, all perfect candidates, 100%. But when it's a UI or anything reliant on display, it's almost impossible. So really, really a tough situation there, but there are other options.
So if I've got an application that is a candidate for containerization, and I'm running it either in-house or maybe in Rackspace or something, what benefits are there for putting it in a container and using Kubernetes or something? Why would I want to do that and not just leave it where it is?
Well, that's a valid question. Okay, so first off, one thing I would look at is, hey, how are you dealing with scale? If this is a, hey, I've just got a Node.js app that's just a single, it's my blog, okay, and it's running Ghost or something like that, and I'm just, you know, running, there's no reason to move that, okay? If you come into, you know, a ton of traffic, that's where Kubernetes lends itself to, hey, I'm going to allow this to scale within the cluster or even have the cluster scale, you know, along with it. And it's more of a scale and management problem at that point. If it's just one, you know, app, hey, just leave it out there, you know, or use, you know, in Azure terms, use app service and you can deploy it there or something like that. They're just, it's a scale management issue. That's where Kubernetes makes it just beautifully easy. And then that's where, hey, I've got multiple of these containers running and one dies, Kubernetes will handle that. It'll bring it back up for you just out of the box. And so there's a beauty in management there. And then along with that, say you've got that scale problem. Well, I only want to pay for what I'm actually using there. All right. And that's where I've got a few VMs out there and they're maxed out. I'm paying for that, all right? Say that later on in the evening or say that you're 8 to 5 type shop and that's when all your traffic is, you can scale that back down so that you're only using the compute that you actually need. It's the density that you can have. And, you know, people tend to forget you are leasing this compute out there, all right? Now, you don't want to lease 50 servers or 50 nodes when you only need 2, all right? And that was, I would say, Kubernetes has come along and it saved a lot of the frustration and pain that the initial cloud deployments had, where they were, you know, deploying 50 servers and, you know, their average CPU time, you know, their average CPU was like 2%. And they're like, why are we paying for all of this? So Kubernetes makes that, you're maximizing your cloud spend. Let's put it that way.
Okay, so even if it is running on a local machine, like in-house, or if it's running in Rackspace or something, it might still be a good idea because I can save the cost of maintenance on the internal machine. And in something like Rackspace, we're paying for that whole machine that's running it the whole time. Whereas with Kubernetes, we might be able to only pay for the amount of time that the application is actually being used.
Yeah, and so that a lot of customers do is they have in-house compute. They have a DC or, you know, look, they have servers in their own. They're like, we've paid for this equipment. It's just sitting there. We're going to use that. We're going to maximize it. And then as we exceed that capacity, then we'll go to the cloud. And that's Kubernetes does a beautiful job of that, too. We have some features that we have that you can do along with that. But that's can't tell you, that's a great example of what a lot of customers are doing right now.
Yeah, and that also sort of highlights one of so that app that you're talking about that maybe you're not getting a lot of scale, but if you had multiple of those apps that aren't getting a lot of scale, you can combine those, if they're containerized, into and take advantage of, instead of having to have a different VM or a different server for each one of those apps, you can sort of take advantage of running those onto the same hardware and getting that even more dense, even though it's not scaling out traffic per app, but it's you can get more apps on the same hardware.
Apps, and that's a very common pattern that we see is customers saying, look, we've got all these apps that we don't necessarily have to re-architect them, we've containerized them, but we want to get them all. Look, they can go on one VM, two VMs, that type of thing, and Kubernetes can just make sure that they run for us, and then you're maximizing that density. And it's gone from, you know, it's, I guess, there's a term somebody used, but it's basically the reduction in VMs, you know, is what it comes down to. There's a cloud native term for that. I can't think of it right now, but it's basically reduction in VMs. So, and they see tremendous cost reduction is what it comes down to.
So when you're trying to plan out one of these, actually taking an application that's a legacy application and saying, hey, let's containerize this, do you have a process in which you sort of checklist the things that you're recommending people to do? Or is it different that you have to do for each application? Or what's sort of the general methodology there?
Right now, I'd say we have a lot of very experienced customers on this front. But initially, it was, can you make it run in a container locally, either on Windows or Mac or Linux? Can you make it run locally? All right. And then I do have to re-architect it in some way, shape, or form. And normally, there's tweaks, just minor tweaks. It's to connection strings and not storing. The big thing is not storing anything in your config files, realizing that you're going to get those, Kubernetes is going to pass those to those containers running. So once they've got it up and running, you know, it's how you handle passing configuration to the actual container itself, the service, however you want to specify that. And then it's almost a process. From once they get to that point, it's like, okay, well, now how do we repeat this? You know, and so do they have CI/CD systems in place? Do they have scanning? You know, how do they scan their images? Is everything in Git? Are they just, you know, they need trusted images? So there is kind of a checklist that we walk through, and it starts with, can you containerize it, Dockerize it, and make it run locally? You know, have you dealt with the configuration management? Then how do you want to do CI/CD for this once you've done it? Is it just going to be somebody's actually pushing out to a container registry and then running their YAML against the Kubernetes cluster right there, which many customers do and I have no problem with? But it's not, if that guy or gal that's doing that gets hit by a bus, it's going to be very difficult to replicate, you know, from that point forward. So yeah, containerize configurations, you know, the registry piece, you know, your artifact or, you know, container registries, and then how do you do CI/CD from there?
So when you're checking for that containerization, you mentioned Windows versus Linux containers. Is there a particular one that you find to work better, or like start with Linux and then switch to Windows, or what, or vice versa?
As a Microsoft employee, it's very difficult for me to say this, but even our product group has said, look, we see Windows containers as a stopgap to Linux.
Okay.
I'm gobsmacked when I heard that the first time. I'm like, we are the Windows company, you know? But if you are using Windows containers right now, I would actively look at re-architecting that application if you expect it to be long-lived. Otherwise, just let it go. We will continue to support it, but then eventually it will die, right? You know, and I think, John, if you remember, the last bullet point on one of my slides of that talk was let the app die. And it sounds awful, but it really may be the case. And it's not a great story, but you're going to see performance benefit with Linux tremendous right now. So a lot of the workloads are going to be .NET that are in that Windows, you know, container space. .NET Core on Linux runs, it's 30, 40% faster than on Windows, you know, and it's lighter. So that .NET Core container running on, I think it's Alpine or something like that, is 80 meg, 100 meg or something like that, versus one that's running on Windows that's 2 gig, 3 gig or something like that. I think maybe 4. So you can see just in terms of portability and performance, Linux is your answer. Okay. Mm-hmm. It pains me to say that, but that's the case right now. Could something change in 6 months? There is active development on that front. Yes. But for right now, that's our stance. And that's a public stance.
So are we trading maintenance and expertise from on-prem server, the IT pros side of things, to the management and maintenance of cloud native applications and Kubernetes applications? Or what is the management story of a containerized application ecosystem?
I would say, ironically, I just had that question today with a customer, that it's even more, anybody that's worried about, I'm going to lose my job, I'm an IT guy that, you know, manages, you know, these they're in for a shock. It's only going to get harder for them because there's network policy that's involved in that. There's security that's involved in that. It's not harder. It's just more complex once you go to the cloud, because instead of, I guess a lot of them, they all wanted their hands on the box. This isn't a Dell under your desktop anymore. This is, it's something out there. It's a little more remote, but as customers become more skilled in Kubernetes, they realize that there are more advanced problems. It's not necessarily more complex. They're just more advanced. I've got these smaller workloads and how do I segregate them? And now I'm trying to densify, you know, this workload on this compute, but I want to be multi-tenant and I want to segregate the traffic between them. And I want to make sure that this app only uses this much resources. So within Kubernetes, you can control that. So there's policy and networking, as well as I would say compute functions that the IT ops person will have to think about that they didn't have to think about before because they had granular control right there on their box or on their switch that they could control. You know, it becomes just subtly different because you're in the cloud and it's layer 7 networking versus, you know, right there in your data center.
One of the points that was made in your talk that seemed to cause some confusion was the issue of storage, data storage using SQL or something like that. Can you explain if our current application that we're lifting and shifting to containers uses SQL? One, can we put SQL in a container? And two, if not, what does the SQL story look like for our new container life?
There's been developments on this front, but it's still not a good story. You can run SQL all you want. Okay. The issue there is how Kubernetes has, your persistent volumes. One pod can connect to one persistent volume. Mm-hmm. All right. That's the issue. At Ready, which is our internal conference last week, there's a team that's working on this, okay, within Kubernetes, and it's SQL, it's Linux SQL running, you know, in a container. And they said that they've, with Azure Storage, have done this and it works seamlessly. They can go and kill a pod and it kills the PVC and it comes up with another pod. And it's, as long as you're running multiples, it'll just seamlessly work. No issues whatsoever. And they're doing HA. I mean, all this stuff, but
that's with one pod accessing the SQL.
Okay, so one pod accesses one persistent volume, and then another. But there's multiple instances of that SQL that each have their own persistent volume. Okay.
Okay.
Does that? I know.
So then, are those like syncing behind the scenes, or?
Yep, 100%. SQL just does all the magic for you. And the other things that they did in this, they were connecting to Oracle, connecting to HDFS, and just reading it seamlessly. Now, I haven't seen this in production yet, so I wouldn't. Hey, caveat emptor. If you try this, it's Buck Hodges. If you want to, you know, you guys can Google that.
Yeah,
it's
Buck Hodges.
He did a talk at Red Hat Summit that was. He did it on OpenShift, which is, you know, basically a management layer over Kubernetes. But from what he's a really smart guy, and I met with him, and he said, "Yes, this works." He's like, "No joke, it's working." This is SQL. So, I told him, I'm like, "Look, I'm dubious. I'm certainly dubious. I want to see this in real life because every customer would want that." But every customer asks about SQL. I mean, it is we're talking diehard Linux shops. They all have SQL somewhere that some executive has some reports in, or they're rolling up to it or something like that. And I'm like, I told him, I'm like, "Buck, if that's the case, you solved 150 of the largest customers in the world's problems right there." And it would be great. It's great for Microsoft because guess what? That's SQL Server. We're selling that. So, and we've simplified the licensing there. So it's not like, hey, some magical per pod thing. We handle all the licensing behind the scenes. So it's really beautiful. But to answer your question about the SQL and storage, the issue is right now that PVC is one pod per PVC. So that's what it comes down to. And it's not a good story. And every customer, prior to last week, I would tell the customer, look, use a PaaS for data. All right. Mm-hmm. Unless you're using some kind of local ephemeral like a Redis, or maybe you're using Mongo to do, you know, key value store or session state right there, and you're okay with losing it, get your data outside of the cluster, use a PaaS, or manage your own IaaS database or NoSQL outside of the cluster, because it's just, you bring your, all the goodness that Kubernetes brings, you're just not taking away, because you're going to have to manage all the data, manage all the PVCs, and it's, then there's HA in that, and you know, a DR, it just gets ugly.
So we've been using a PaaS in production, but in our environments, our testing, especially like our automated integration tests and those sort of things, we've been actually spinning up images of SQL that have data built baked into that image. So we just have like our golden data in those images. And because we don't care what happens to that afterwards, we can, but that allows us to spin up a specific instance of that database really easily, because we can just have that VM and replicate those tests over and over again as much as we want.
And that's what's funny. We have a workshop that does that, where we show them, we bake in some image and bake in some data that kind of rolls up like that. And then they enter a voting app and all this. And then we have them delete the pod and watch the data, and they're like, what happened to the data? Well, you know what, that's, it goes with that, and then they it comes back up, and sure, it has that base, like what you're saying, that base data that they've got there, but after that it's gone. It's like you're starting over. And so once they see that, they kind of grasp what could happen. And even if you have a PVC that is attached there, there's lots of times where there's corruption there, where it's not just a, you know, hey, the pod dies and the kind of it, it's a weird, you know, it gets corrupt. And more reason why I, until there's solid evidence that you, that those, that that in cluster database actually functions well, okay, my suggestion is to use a PaaS. It's just easier on everyone, management, the developer, everything, because it just from a developer's perspective, just give me the connection string. That's all I need. I just, that's it. You pass that in, I'm good to go.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. I mean, even after your talk, you know, I assumed the answer to the question was, no, it's a bad idea, just don't do it. But, I mean, the fact that people are like, we think this could be a good idea, it just doesn't work yet, that's pretty cool.
Well, and it, what's funny is I do run into customers that say that they're going to be the ones that solve it. You know, I in my mind, it's going to be one of the big three. Okay, maybe even Oracle, but it's going to be one of those big three that's it's going to be, you know, Azure, you know, AWS or Google that solve that in some way, shape, or form, because there's too many customers asking for it. But I don't think it's going to be some Joe off the street, you know. Mm-hmm. It's like, look, I made this work, it's magical, and I'm like, sorry, there's, you know, we have hundreds of thousands of engineers working on this, you know, the SQL team is working on this, you know, and I'm sure Google has, you know, big table people and big query guys, you know, working on this. So, I mean,
I'm waiting for Microsoft to solve it and to be sure to let us know. I mean, there are so many offerings these days, and technology inside of Azure is moving so quickly. I mean, just the amount of container technologies that are available is sometimes confusing. Like, there's ACI and AKS and all these different things. So where do you go? Do you go straight to docs to figure everything out? Do you go to look for videos and blog posts? Or where do you go? What are the offerings? Where do people want to start?
Well, I would say that, yeah. So our docs weren't, it's so tough to keep up to, and it's not a problem of our, all the other cloud providers have the same problem. Technology changes so quickly. It's so tough to keep up with that. Our docs are becoming, we're throwing more people at that team to keep it more up to date. You're going to see more and more updates. I would say docs is your first choice. GitHub. The thing is, docs runs off of GitHub. Mm-hmm. So every time there's a commit to master or, you know, PR, it's going to reflect that on the docs site. Yeah, docs is a good place. There's there's a container. I think we have a container team blog, but that's not going to be as updated. That's just going to be like service announcements or anything like that. The docs team is consistently updating examples, any type of new features that we're adding, because the blog team is just going to blog about, hey, we added, you know, virtual node support, or we added, hey, there's a new plugin for, you know, different pluggable things for within Kubernetes or Prometheus, or, you know, different operators that are supported. It's more on a grand scale. The docs team is going to be updating all the little features that you've got. But as far as container offerings, look, I mean, the big thing is we've got, you know, Kubernetes at AKS. You've got app service for containers, all right? And you've got ACI, or Azure Container Instances. And ACI is more for test workloads, or maybe a WordPress site or something like that that you want to run out there. You can get a public IP. It can be in your own VNet. App service is more for, hey, you want that scale, but you want us to kind of manage the servers on it. And ACI kind of gets that, but you don't get the same type of scale. And then you move up to AKS, where you're kind of get the managed aspect of it, not fully managed, because you still have to manage some pieces of the actual nodes. Yeah, there are a lot of container offerings, and they're rapidly changing. So Docs is the best choice, you know, for that. Twitter is always a good choice. I just it depends on who you follow, and I could give you a list of 1,000 people to follow on that. But, you know, Azure Docs are good. Kubernetes.io is also very good because it lists all the different places you can do all these different things. Docker, you know, has a pretty good blog on their main website as well. There's numerous places to go to, but you're right. I mean, it's so hard to keep up on what's changing, what's new, the new product offerings by all the different cloud providers. So,
well, to close things out, we kind of go in a little bit of different direction. And it's one of the things we ask all the guests that we have on, if they would, you know, think back to when you got started, and maybe, you know, give some words of wisdom to people who are just getting started, or maybe trying to level up their career. What would you say to them?
Read everything. The amount that I read every day, and I'm talking everywhere. And with the advent of mobile phone, you got to remember when we all started, we didn't have mobile phones. It was just, you know, we would have a computer. Now we've got a phone. I read all the time, and it's hard if you've got kids and all that stuff. Sorry, but I read all the time. I read dissenting viewpoints. I read competitors' viewpoints. I read what they're doing. That's the biggest thing, to see everyone's perspective on it and what technology is going. I look at GitHub trending every single day. It's every start of every day. I look at GitHub. What's trending today? What's trending this week? Part of that is, hey, yeah, it's programming languages and it's commits from open source, but it's also, that's kind of where things are going. It'll tell you like what they're working on. Is it UI? Is it more server stuff? And if you look out there now, it's a lot of infrastructure stuff. It sounds weird, but a coding site that's, you know, doing infrastructure as code. So GitHub trending. And then the other thing, the key piece is find a mentor. And it could be anybody. I've been extremely lucky. Right place, right time, over and over again. Find good mentors. I had several that led me into Microsoft. And while I've been at Microsoft, I've had several here that have just been awesome. So I wish there were resources online that could direct you to the right ones. Like I said, I've been lucky from that perspective. But, you know, that would be the big thing. Find a mentor that's kind of seen the ropes and, you know, knows, hey, don't do this or that.
Okay. And then I know you were sort of mentioning some of these resources. What resources might you be able to point people to that are trying to get started containerizing their legacy applications or just working with the cloud stuff? You started mentioning a bunch of those things right before then, but what would you point people to?
For those legacy applications, we have one that's out there. It's on... I'll get that. There's a link out there that It shows you, should you containerize this legacy workload? And then kind of gives you like a flow of what you need to do from that perspective. And a lot of those lead to no, by the way. But anyway, it gives a good workflow on that. Docker has one, because Docker has a really good, with their Docker Enterprise offering, they're saying that a lot of these legacy applications you can run on Docker Enterprise Edition, which is, once again, a kind of an overlay to Kubernetes. And then there's quite a few, just as far as getting started, just on Docker, containerizing your first, your first app. It may not be a legacy app, but it'll at least get you a good solid foundation for understanding how a container works, how Docker works. And then you can work your way back to saying, okay, now I can take this legacy workload and containerize it from there.
Perfect. And then what if people want to follow you? What sort of social media accounts, Twitter, would you kind of...
I would say mention too. So at Son of Jor-El on Twitter, if nobody knows what that is, that's Superman. but at Son of Jor-El on Twitter, and then Jay Schluchter on GitHub.
Okay.
You'll see all my different commits. I work on various open source projects within Microsoft and then outside of it. You'll see plenty of activity about what's going on and everything like that. And that seems to be fairly popular lately, following people on GitHub. But yeah, Twitter and GitHub. So,
do you have any upcoming speaking engagements that you might want to sort of shout out?
Yeah, so there's next week. It's July 30th. It's at j4k.io. It's in Orlando. It's the J4K conference. We're doing Java on Kubernetes. And specifically in this case, it's OpenShift. So obviously, there's a ton of Java workloads out there. People want to know, hey, how do I containerize this? And how do I put it on Kubernetes or OpenShift? So yeah, it's Orlando. And I think it's a 1 o'clock time slot next Tuesday. Is it Tuesday in Orlando? That's my next one. And then there's more coming up, but they're further out. So.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Joey. Really appreciate you coming on the show.
Yeah. Thanks for having me, guys.
That was Joey Schluchter. Joey is a cloud native technical specialist from Microsoft and a member of the global Black Belt Azure team.
If you like this episode, please like, rate, and review on iTunes.
Find show notes, blog posts, and more at sixfiguredev.com.
And be sure to follow us on Twitter at sixfiguredev.
This has been another episode of the Six Figure Developer Podcast, helping others reach their potential. I am John Calloway.
I'm Clayton Hunt.
And I'm John Ash.